Whatever you do, whatever you enjoy, you need your health. Welcome to The Original Guide to Men's Health, a podcast designed for men of all ages to learn about and access good health. This guide shares knowledge on how to be and stay healthy, maintenance and prevention strategies, along with reviews of conditions and issues affecting wellness are explored. Please join me, your host, Dr. Richard Pellman, as I interview renowned experts who will provide you with timely, relevant, and vital information so that you can embark on a journey towards better health. For more information from this podcast, including take-home points and resource links, we invite you to visit our website, theoriginalguidetomenshealth.org. You can also find us on social media. We invite you to follow us there and share episodes on Twitter, Facebook, and LinkedIn. Why is it that some of us are so rigorous about our health maintenance? Why is it that others don't participate in the healthcare system? Why is it that some will rigorously attend to preventive visits while others wait until something happens? Why is it that some of us watch our diets and exercise and avoid risk-taking behavior while others not so much? Today on this episode of The Original Guide to Men's Health, we will explore health behavior. There are a number of models that govern thoughts about why we do what we do and why we don't. We'll look into what is the background of these various theories, what we know about them, and how we can change them. Helping us explore these various models of health behavior are Dr. Grace Lasker. Dr. Lasker is PhD, MCHES, CN, CHC. She is Director of Health Studies, Teaching Professor of Nursing and Health Studies, Adjunct Teaching Professor, Department of Environmental and Occupational Health Sciences, University of Washington, Bothell. Joining her is Dr. Joseph Henrich. Dr. Henrich is the Ruth Moore Professor, Department of Human Evolutionary Biology at Harvard University. Dr. Henrich has explored various models of health behavior and has, in fact, written a number of books. His most recent book in 2020, The Weirdest People in the World and How the West Became Psychologically Peculiar and Particularly Prosperous, is now out for your pleasure. So as we continue to discuss issues regarding why we tend to look after ourselves or we don't, why we might ignore that pain while others will go seek an opinion about why do they have the pain or that sore that's not healing, or perhaps the bleeding that they notice in their bowel movements, or perhaps that irregular heartbeat or chest pain. Why is that? Why, as we evolve through humankind, have some of us now paid more attention to what we can do to take care of ourselves, while others don't? To help us, let's have our guests give us their opinion about some of the theories surrounding our health behavior. I'm going to begin with Dr. Lasker. Grace, why don't you go ahead and give us your thoughts of what we know about various types of behavior and theories surrounding it.
Thank you so much. It's an important question because it brings with it that idea that some have capability and others don't, when that's actually not what's going on when we think about why we do something or why we can't stop doing another thing. And so we really are just on different spaces of that journey through that ability to make change. And that's all it is. So some of us are further along in these different stages of being able to make decisions to go to the doctor or go to the gym or stop smoking or any of these number of changes that we're all inundated with that we feel like we have to make. It's really just where we are in that process of getting to that action. So we're all on different places. We don't have even playing grounds even. So a lot of us are able to access that sort of action and healthcare and support structures that a lot of others don't have access to. So we're not all playing the same game. We're not all at the same place of being able to have and achieve our goals. And it's not our fault.
And Dr. Joseph Henrick, your background and thoughts on this.
Yeah, so I come at this from the point of view of evolutionary biology and thinking about what makes us human. And in my investigations, one of the key things that really stands out with humans is that we're evolved to be powerful cultural learners, that constantly, from the time we're young children, we're consciously and unconsciously looking out into the world and selectively picking different members of our social group to acquire ideas, beliefs, values, habits. And this goes on often unconsciously. So we often, one of the folk models we have, so now thinking about this like an anthropologist, is that, you know, people get knowledge and then they make decisions based on their knowledge. But actually, a very powerful determinant that's often even more powerful than knowledge is just the habits we've acquired unconsciously by observing others. There's a set of ideas around what we look for. So one of the things we know people look for are things like prestige and status. So we take in ideas that we see particularly prestigious or successful individuals doing. We're also biased by sex. So males tend to copy males, females tend to copy females. So you can end up with different cultural traditions in a sense in males and females. We also copy those who share our ethnic markers. We use things like language and dialect and preferentially learn from those folks. And a final thing I'll just mention here kind of in this opening is that we also use what are called credibility enhancing displays. So if someone tells you that they do something or tells you you should do something, that's a lot less powerful than hearing that and seeing them actually do it. So seeing it demonstrated in a way that, you know, they went to the trouble, they paid some costs, and then they actually did it. And that actually acts more powerfully on our unconscious than just straight verbal transmission. And we see these things across all kinds of areas. And one subtle one that is actually the experience of pain. So it's easy to show in a laboratory experiment. If you see someone not expressing pain at the exact same physical stimuli as a someone else who's expressing more pain, you will either express more or less pain and report more or less pain, depending on what you see. And you see these in other health-related behaviors. So something like hand washing has been well studied, and even something like suicide. The news channels, for example, don't report on celebrity suicides because when they're reported, people are more likely to commit suicide actually copying method. And if it's a male that commits suicide, other males tend to commit suicide, females the same. And then people also match on ethnicity. So there are all these powerful unconscious forces shaping our behavior.
It's a complex discussion because there are so many factors that go into this. Joe, I like that you mentioned pain. My high school gymnastics coach, I was also a football coach, and his mantra was, there's no such thing as pain. So, you know, we were taught to ignore it and press through it.
My high school coach, my swim coach, our motto was, pain is weakness leaving your body.
And, you know, of course, that's one of the theories about why guys differ in their approach to healthcare. Big boys don't cry, suck it up, don't be a wimp, versus, you know, get in there, take care of yourself. If it hurts, look into it. It could be something bad. And there's just this hesitancy among members of the male population to engage. On the other hand, again, there are so many influences. You know, are we only bound by culture, or is it knowledge deficit? Do we look at the influence of our immediate relationships and those around us, and how do we perceive that? And then, of course, if somebody offers you a solution or a path, as you were saying, is it something that we buy into? So, you know, this is really one of those mainstays of how we convince patients that this is what we want for their, you know, better health, whether it's a medication or whether it's a lifestyle change. Just one example I had was I always ask patients about their smoking and were they interested in stopping smoking. And it wasn't to demean anybody or belittle anybody. It was just offering that I could send them somewhere where they could get more help. And aside from the cardiovascular disease, the pulmonary disease, and I mentioned their increased risk of bladder cancer, it was like an awareness that all of a sudden drew interest. And I don't know what it was about having potential for bladder cancer that was different than heart attack, stroke, peripheral vascular disease, or lung cancers or pulmonary issues. But it seemed to have a lot of patients get motivated who otherwise weren't to stop smoking. So I just use that as one example. So Grace, I'm going to go back to you about more input on the thoughts about what influences our behavior.
Yeah, you know, the really exciting part about our dialogue so far is that Joe just spoke to us about something that in public health we call the social cognitive theory. And Richard, you just brought up the tenets of what we call the health behavior theory. So researchers have been studying how people interact since the beginning of observation and time. In public health, we've been able to translate people's activity and action and non-action into about 5 different theories that say, hey, you know what? We can actually predict the success and the behaviors of people just based on these patterns that we see over and over and over. So I mentioned 2 of these theories, the social cognitive theory. That one really does say, hey, look, you're not only who you are, but you are also a consequence of the environment around you, your social structure, your physical environment, your past experiences. So that imprinting of experience on how you make decisions and behaviors now is significant. And then your own personal sort of physiological, mental, and biological capacities too. You put all of that together. And Richard, you're right. It is an extremely complex set of variables for us to have to navigate, along with, pandemics and growing cancer rates and mental health issues and all the other things that we're just trying to balance and make it through. So it's really exciting to think about what drives people to want to make change. And you had said that that bladder cancer aspect of it for a lot of your folks was the change agent that made them say, okay, I should do something about it. In the health behavior model, we call that coming into a space of understanding what the perceived severity of the situation is, what the perceived susceptibility the individual has in that being a problem in their lives, the perceived benefits of change, and then the perceived barriers of change. And all of that work has to happen. You have to move through and come to a good place in all of those just to be able to be ready to think about making a change.
2 things come to mind that are relevant to this discussion. The first is that we found in a lot of our research that the contents of stories can have a big effect on people's behavior, more so than giving them statistics and numbers. So knowing a rich, detailed story with visceral components are more likely to lead to behavioral changes than giving people a bunch of numbers or giving them a more or less memorable story. So I think stories can play a big role in this kind of thing. And the other thing I wanted to mention is just some more examples of the ways in which those around you affect you. So in simple experiments, you can put people around others at a meal that either you systematically have the people around them eat less or eat more. And that then affects the amount that the person's sitting there. And the same thing with food choice. So people are also affected by how much of each food they take based on what those around them are doing. So you really got to pick your partners.
There is so much that influences this. If you're looking at your cultural history, you know, is your culture in one of those cultures where health is really important? And, you know, there are those blue zones where people live longer. Is that diet and their activity and it's culturally based? Is it your bringing up? You know, how did your parents bring you up? Were they attentive to their medical needs? I have a slide in my men's health talk of, it was a birthday card my daughter sent me, but shows a grandfather who you can tell he's advanced in years. He has gray hair like I do. And he's sitting there with his fishing rod and a fly. And his little grandson is just looking up at grandpa in the most adoring way. And the quote is, "And Jimmy, that's the tale of my first colonoscopy." And, you know, maybe if Jimmy grows up knowing that grandpa regularly got colonoscopies, that will just evolve into, well, that's part of healthcare. I need to do that. And so I always use that as a translation of what is perceived as sort of something we should do because it's been in culture. It's how you grew up knowing that that was a behavior that you should undertake. Obviously, the other things you're talking about are totally important. Take vaccinations. You know, what do you perceive as the harm? What do you perceive as the benefits? Do you buy off on the benefits? Do you think you're at risk? Do you think you're more at risk from getting the vaccination than from what it can protect you to? I mean, these are huge challenges in this day and age. So go ahead and expound on any of that.
Yeah, I mean, I think in the case of vaccines, you know, vaccine resistance is often associated with particularly lurid tales of children who are born with problems and deficits and all this kind of thing, which are very memorable. And so that has a big effect.
We call those outliers. They're sensational and frightening because they're outliers. When you think about the folks in your lives or the stories that you've heard and how we think about what our potential for success of changing a behavior is, for example, you know, we think about the celebrities that lost 200 pounds and, you know, that message of if they can do it, I should be able to do it. But that's that message that in this country, in the culture that's been growing over the decades and centuries for this country, that it's on you aspect of it is what's failing us because it's not just on us. And furthermore, for most of us, we live in systems that are not designed for our success. So let me give you an example about that. We have these things called social determinants of health. So you think of health and you automatically think biology, right? Oh, it's you have this disease or your body's doing this or you need to make your body be healthy to do these things. Like biology, that part really comes to mind very easily. What we don't necessarily know is the social aspects of health that have even greater of an impact on our health status. So clinical care, about 20% of our success is due to us getting to the hospitals and getting to the doctors and that sort of thing when we have a problem. 80% of our health and wellness status is because of these social and cultural factors. So for example, what kind of job do you have? What's your education level? Do you have access to healthcare? Do you have access to transportation? So these things that have nothing to do with health actually have the greatest impact on your health and wellness status.
Absolutely. Joe, do you want to have any thoughts on that too?
Yeah, well, and one of the things that I think is sometimes hidden in the background of that research is that as part of acquiring our cultural practices, people in different social environments acquire different practices, including things like, so economists study temporal discounting, and that's the degree to which you prioritize present things versus future things. And a lot of investments in health are way off in the future, right? So, you know, you might not have these health consequences for smoking now because of things you'll do in the future. It turns out our willingness to discount the future is actually something we are heavily influenced by learning from other people. So if you grow up in an environment where people are discounting the future heavily, then you're likely to discount the future heavily as well, and then engage in practices that don't benefit you in the future.
The idea of health resources that Grace brought up is, you know, obvious in those who have insurance, don't have insurance. If you're rural, perhaps you have to travel 2 hours to get to the closest healthcare. What is available? What is involved in your getting to the healthcare? Do you have to leave your job, missing a day's pay if they don't give you a sick day or you've used your sick days? Do they allow for wellness visits and still give you a salary? How do you get there? As you said, transportation. Do you have to, you know, borrow somebody's car? Do you have to take public transportation and that extends the day? And then people sometimes go and they go, well, you know, I saw the practitioner, whether it's physician, nurse practitioner, PA, and then I had to go for another study, but they couldn't do it that day. So I had to repeat that cycle. And it's more than just the question of getting the care delivered. It's the access and the other issues involved in it. And then we look at the influences of, is there good communication with the provider? Does the patient who's being examined understand what is at stake? You know, I always thought part of what I should do is medical translation. Make sure that somebody really understands what I'm trying to get them to participate in. I'll throw out for more discussion. Joe?
Yeah, I mean, it's a little bit outside of my area. One other example that I wanted to mention, just that really illustrates the power of some of this role modeling stuff, is around 2014, and the British government wanted to persuade women to seek breast cancer screening for this particular gene that increases your likelihood of breast cancer screening. And they had been engaging in a public health campaign to try to get women to get more screened, in a relatively unsuccessful campaign. And then around May, the writer-director Angelina Jolie wrote an op-ed in the New York Times where she told her personal story of her decision to get a double mastectomy and her experiences around that, her concerns with her mother who had passed away. And this lit up the switchboards at screening clinics all over the Anglosphere, from New Zealand to the US to the UK, all because one person who is not particularly knowledgeable about medical practices or cancer was able to relate her personal story about this. And so this kind of thing can be a very powerful tool, I think, if properly used.
Grace?
Yeah, I'm thinking about my responsibilities as a public health practitioner. And I think about every day folks who try really hard to make good decisions and they fail or they feel like they failed. And I just want to say that that's on me. Like, I didn't do my job as a public health practitioner to set up systems that are there for you. You shouldn't have to worry about how can I get to this clinic. You shouldn't have to worry about, I don't know if this thing is dangerous for me because I can't understand what this research words are. You know, that's our failure as a health system to provide what you needed. So I really want to make sure that everybody that's listening that has ever tried to make any kind of change or make good health behaviors, that we're all in this together. It's not on you. And so when we can come together, like Joe's been saying, this social network and this influence that we have, we call the sphere of influence, if we can all help each other, we will get further along than that lone wolf ideology of this is on me. And if it doesn't work, I failed.
Yeah, Joe, it certainly helps when we have celebrities who will lead by letting the public know, or somebody who people are aware of giving a position towards the benefit of the public. You know, in this day and age, we have some influencers who are anti-vaccination or other issues. And, you know, then we have people butting heads. And again, we have to find this common ground of influence and have people respond to hopefully legitimate data.
The details of public health and medicine are a little bit outside of my field, but I was going to ask you guys, one of the things that it seems to me from the kind of work I do that would be effective is when your physician tells you stuff, you kind of want to know what they do. There's a way in which I wonder if there's a way for physicians and other medical providers to make it clear that they practice what they preach. The way we have things set up, that's like considered, you know, the physician is the dispenser of great wisdom, and you really don't know what they do back, you know, when they're at home. And there could be a way to make this all more personal by making the patient realize that the physicians and the other medical staff are practicing what they preach. Otherwise, it just seems like cheap talk, right? And people are very resistant to cheap talk.
Well, and Joe, that makes me think of the fact that we have hardly any people of color and physicians of color supporting these communities. So it's like, well, you can say that's the way that you would do that, but that's your culture and your identity. That's not what we do. So there's this idea of cultural competency in healthcare, and it's really making sure that that identity and historical cultural aspects of health are brought into that conversation. I always think about my kids and, you know, like telling them they need to eat their broccoli. And they're like, I don't like broccoli. And I could say, well, I'm a nutritionist, so I know this is the right thing to do, but they don't like it. So they're not going to do it, or they're not going to do it with a healthy attitude. And then when they get older, they're going to say, man, I really hate broccoli because my mom just kept on making me eat it. But if I had like actually thought about, well, what would you eat? And let's promote that sort of healthy eating, like let's eat an apple or let's have some strawberries. Their concept around what health and nutrition and wellness would be is absolutely different. So I think about that from a cultural capacity. We need to make sure that we have all identities represented in those healthcare spaces too.
Yeah, there's a whole line of experiments looking at ways to manipulate what kids eat. And the single most powerful way to get kids to eat and get them to like new foods is to put them around slightly older kids who are of the same sex who love whatever it is you want to get them to eat. And they see the other kids eating and they're like, oh, I want to eat some of that. Then they get going.
I think, Joe, your comments about, you know, physicians kind of practice what they preach, you know, where there's been an evolution in an approach to patient care. I think a couple of generations ago, patients just expected to be told what to do by the physician without any explanation. It was a trust, and you go to the physician, you trust your doctor, the doctor knows, and that you just do this. And when I started, I was always trying to explain to patients, and some of the older patients said, doc, you don't got to explain it to me, just tell me what I need to do. And I always felt like, well, I was cheating the patient without giving a background and explanation in order to have them trust me. And there are so many resources now. Actually, I just heard a great lecture on artificial intelligence from some folks from the lab at Microsoft. And part of what I had always wanted into the electronic medical record is the fact that instead of having your doctor sitting there typing and, you know, engaging with you, that as soon as you sit down with whatever complaint it is, it populates the screen. It hears, it knows, and there are resources there immediately available so that a discussion can be undertaken between the physician or the practitioner and the patient. And also, there has to be a good understanding of where the patient's coming from as far as cultural background or needs or necessities. Again, everybody is not out of the same mold. I always thank my anthropology background for helping with that. And I think that's part of medical school curriculum that is so important in how to engage patients and understanding where they're coming from. So as we go through, I just want to look at a couple of things that we're discussing, and people are going, well, okay, cigarette smoking. You know, I put cigarette smoking in as an addiction. It is. It's addictive. It's different than a health behavior of you're eating too many potato chips today, you know, as a nutritional source. So when you're dealing with addictions versus a behavior, you are looking at behavior change, but it's a lot more difficult. Grace, any comments about addictions?
Yeah, that's the most difficult thing to overcome. And I'll actually push back because I think that there's all sorts of addictions, and those potato chips, absolutely. And there's biological reasons for adaptations for addiction, and there's social aspects. And so really trying to pull on the thread of what's actually the reason. But it, ultimately, it's just accepting that it is an addiction and that you do have that, and it's not your fault. Like, I keep on going back to this. We keep on blaming ourselves around these things, and it's just absolutely not. And so addiction is one of those aspects of there are so many other factors that brought us into it. So we all have the capacity for addiction, but we're not all addicts. So why is that? Well, that goes back to that framework of there are these social constructs, there are the job that you have, the stress that you have, and all these different things come together to really say, hey, I can be protected against addiction, or I have such a higher risk of falling into addictive behavior because of these things. But biologically and genetically, we all have this capacity. So it's those other aspects that really, one, decide on our behalf, are we going to be coming into that addiction space? And B, can we get ourselves out of it?
One of the things I wanted to mention, so I've been emphasizing the kind of cultural transmission side of this, but one of the other things that we work on in my lab is the idea that humans have a norm psychology, and that we're trying to figure out what the social rules are. And we spend a lot of time worrying about, you know, complying with the local standards or the local social norms and stuff. And in some communities, you know, cigarette smoking would be a violation of the local social norm and people think badly about. And in that kind of environment, it's much easier to not smoke because there's this constant concern about reputational management. But of course, that norm varies across communities. And so simply being able to manipulate that norm could be a powerful tool. Of course, norms also can have bad effects. So it's not all a good story because, you know, that can affect things like body image and the spread of eating disorders and whatnot. So it's a piece of human psychology, and we have to learn how to use that for, you know, to promote health as opposed to suppress it.
So as we move into, you know, solutions looking at what forms our judgment about our health behavior, what models there are, then how would you address actually change? I'm going to start with the developing brain of a teenager that still has certain areas where risk-taking behavior may not be fully considered. And, you know, as a society, do we adopt certain things to protect the population, even though the individual rights say, don't protect me? But certain people need protecting until they can truly have a well-formed brain and make decisions. So if each of you have any thoughts about that, go ahead.
Grace?
In public health, we say that the only way to successfully move people into health and wellness is through policy. Policy forces behavior change in incredible ways through large swaths of our population. And so seatbelt use is a great example of that. When we made it a law, there was absolutely a decrease in the amount of motor vehicle harm and injuries and death related to seatbelt use or disuse at the moment. So we look at this as a policy responsibility that at the level of law and rules, societal level rules, we are saying we should be protective to the population because individuals don't all have the same access to that protection. And I really want to emphasize that our communities of color are differently abled and marginalized identifying individuals do not simply have access to the same resources to protect them from harm. And they don't have access to the same resources to move them into a space of healing and health and wellness. They can barely even afford food, much less access to healthcare, or feeling as if they're even allowed to think about something like going to the doctor. So at the population level, if we're working very hard to ensure that we're leveling that playing field of access to these protective factors, that's the only way that we're really going to make huge change.
Building on that idea and thinking about adolescents, adolescents are less inclined towards risk in some domains, they're particularly concerned about what their peers think of them and what their peers are doing. So that can actually be a useful tool. So one program I know that has had some success is in terms of like excessive drinking among college students. If you tell them what the actual norm of drinking, which might be less than what they guess it is, it'll then cause them to move down and drink less. So just resetting what they think normal is.
It's a education and knowledge base, again, getting the buy-off depending on who's surrounding you and exactly what are your friends doing? You know, who do you follow? Who influences you? How do you make your decisions and what do you base your decisions on? If we were looking at trying to move individuals towards a healthier lifestyle and say you're lecturing to health providers, let's just give them some information as things they should and shouldn't be doing as they approach individuals. Grace, I'll start with you. So you're lecturing to, whether it's medical students, nursing students, your undergraduates who are contemplating healthcare or healthcare providers in any sense. What things should they be looking to do and not to do? And we mentioned shaming. We don't want to shame individuals. We don't want to make them feel guilty, but expand on that.
Actually, I feel like there's more harm in saying that I expect this from you because I expect this from myself. So you should mirror my behavior. I think there's actually more harm in that. And it goes back to that thing of, I don't see myself in you. And you're saying that I have to do these things, but I'm not feeling that I have to do those things. So that disconnect really erodes that trust with that clinician or that community healthcare worker. And really then makes you say, I don't want to have to keep hearing this person tell me something that doesn't mean anything to me, or that I technically, physically cannot do because my religion doesn't allow me to, or my cultural background doesn't encourage me to. And so if you're a clinician, really thinking about that cultural care competency model, and then really we need to reimagine that too, because that's a deficit-minded model where we're still focusing on, you know, what are the negative aspects of the patient? But if we reimagine that in terms of like this, a strength-based healthcare model, now we're going to pull out the strengths of the individual. So I'm not going to say you need to eat better because look at your AC1 levels. I'm going to say, wow, you have an extreme passion for your family. And that's an incredible driver to maybe all of you can think about what you might do differently to look at your AC1 models and try to get them down. So really pulling on the strengths that individuals and cultures have, rather than looking at the deficiencies, is one really important shift that I think we can make in that patient to provider care.
Joe's question, it was a very common ask of patients, so what would you do, to me as their provider? And my response was always, you know, you're an individual, I'm an individual. My decision tree is not necessarily going to be the same as yours based on my health issues, my background issues. And that's why we're approaching you as an individual. You know, certainly if it was, I think you should treat this versus not, I give as much background and knowledge. And that's the other thing I really ask people to buy off on, that medicine as a science is something that is dynamic. And when we learn something that is contrary to what we used to know, we pass that along. And people have been saying, well, that what you told me was wrong. Well, no, it was correct at the time, but we have learned more. So we probably overtreated prostate cancer in early years. Now we have learned more about the biology of prostate cancer, and we realize there are some forms of prostate cancer that may never harm the patient and can successfully be watched and monitored without treatment. But it wasn't wrong at the time. It's just an evolution of knowledge. And I think that's so important for people to understand. That happened during COVID is, well, they were wrong. They weren't wrong. We didn't know anything about this virus, and we evolved our knowledge about it. And as we evolved our knowledge about it, we adapted what we told people to do. And unfortunately, it got construed as, well, see, they were wrong, and this led to all kinds of issues. And, Joe, if you have any thoughts of how to unplug that kind of behavior.
Yeah. So, I mean, you guys are the practitioners. I'm just the theorist. I mean, I wonder if there is room to be creative and try to address the concerns that Grace was thinking of, but also try to get this sense in which people are looking for role models and they really want social information. So could you have something rather than giving the patient the sort of facts, figures, and statistics, or in addition to that, you also tell them, you know, these are five patients from the past. Of course, everything's anonymized. And this is their situation. And this is the decision they made. And this is the decision they made. So people have a sense of how people deal with these issues, what kinds of people are doing different things. I mean, that could be a way through this. And it would give people individuals they could potentially connect with, and then some social information about an actual decision that someone made. There's no deception here.
And you are spot on. In fact, for each disease, there are support groups that we make available to patients, because nothing is more comforting than speaking with somebody who's been through something and, well, what did you do? And, you know, I would ask patients if they'd be willing to talk to other patients, and most would, of course. And I said, you know, it'd be kind of be on a first name basis, but it was very helpful to have that kind of support. So if we looked at, though, a influence of one of our listeners is saying, okay, I need to get healthy. How to make changes in their life? What should they do? How do you approach that? Joe, go ahead.
Find a community of people who have the same interests and are already further along in the process than you are, and then hang around them.
Grace, thoughts?
There's a model. So I mentioned those five different models that can predict people's behavior. And one of them is just got this really fancy, scary name. It's called the trans-theoretical model. And basically what this model says is that the process of getting through to change is a process. And it's a process that takes a long time. So I think the very first thing is we have to give ourselves grace in saying nobody can make change overnight. It's literally not how our biology works. Our brains are hardwired into behavior and action. And so some studies, Joe knows this way more than I, says it takes at least 6 months to re-engage your brain in a different habit. not conquer a change of habit, but just start to think about maybe I can successfully do something different. And you start to actually do that thing different. So eating more vegetables is a great example. So in this trans-theoretical model, the stages before you actually start doing something could take years, and that's okay and normal. So you have to think about it. You have to contemplate. You have to think about what is the severity of it? What's going to happen if I don't? What will happen if I do? And you have to get to a good place where everything comes together for you to say, I'm ready. And then that's the preparation stage. So you're still not actively making this change. You're prepping for it. You're getting really close. You're like within 30 days of saying, I'm going to do this. So that preparation is also called the determination stage. If you feel like you're there to that place, you're incredible. You have done years of work you didn't even know you were doing. And that next stage, action, is within reach. So be very proud of that work that you didn't even know that you were doing, and get yourself ready in that preparation, in that determination space, to be able to take action. That's the hardest part of all of this. The action part, that's Joe's really important aspect of that social support to be able to move you through that. That actually is the easier part if we have access to those social communities. So whereas we say that community can really help you, if you're alone, we know that your health outcomes are significantly decreased and you're vulnerable to so many things without that. So the other side I would say is, as Joe said, you need to create that community first before you even get started into actualizing change.
We have a certain amount of crisis management in medicine where we're referring to, we just diagnosed, a kidney cancer in my specialty. And now, you know, everything was good till it's not. But I remember a patient who said, all that care I was taking in myself, and I still have this. I go, well, you're here. We can take care of it. And the fact that you exercised and you were taking care of yourself means that you will come through in your recovery much more easily than had you not been already in good shape. And, you know, so that was a benefit that was unrecognized till there was sort of a crisis management of, we need to do the surgery to take care of this. So sometimes there's benefits that people don't perceive that come along the way in the crisis mode rather than just the usual management mode. So that's an excellent point. I leave both of you with any additional thoughts that you might have for somebody who's listening in as far as being able to make an adaptation towards better health management, and better health behavior.
That we are all doing our best, even when we think we're not. And that's because we are navigating very complex things just to make it through the day. So I do want to continue to say that you are doing incredible, even if you don't feel like you are. And part of that incredible work is the journey of understanding and knowing. So whereas facts and figures, absolutely, just for most of us, it doesn't mean anything, but knowing the potential reasons why you might be struggling actually do help. And so I want to actually bring up something that I know that we don't talk about it. And it's something that we call intergenerational impact. It's a fancy way of saying that the way that you are now, the way that you make decisions, the choices that you make, your mental health status, your physical health status, is actually because of the choices that your grandparents and your great-grandparents made before you even knew what their names were. So there's this thing where if, for example, I'm going to talk about anxiety, a lot of us have anxiety and we're like, what's wrong with us? Why can't I just feel okay? I'm doing everything. I'm taking all these pills. I'm doing all this stuff and I still don't feel right. Why? It's being able to answer that why that is very empowering. And so anxiety and stress are a very great example of this intergenerational impact. So we've done all this research on our genetics that says if your mother or your grandparents or your father, anybody in your direct line of ancestry, if they underwent a severe trauma or stress moments, that they physically changed the way that you generations later respond to stress. So you're sitting here saying there's something wrong with me because I get super stressed out when I hear loud noises. And yet it was because your grandmother went through a situation with famine or had a PTSD moment, or your grandfather or your mother. And you have no idea what that history is. Nobody tells these stories anymore. And yet somehow it's your fault. So I also want to bring up this idea that we're working against so many things that if we can just have stout heart and know that this is the long game, life is hopefully the long game, that these changes and these things that we feel like we need to do, this is not a short-term thing. This is a longer-term way in which we just make it through life every single day.
My only addition to that excellent point is that I would recommend that people keep their eye on taking baby steps, right? Pick one thing, do it until you got it, and then pick a second thing, and then do it until you got it, and try to build up that way. Baby steps.
Yeah, I will throw out to my Canadian colleague who started the Canadian Men's Health Network. People just Google "don't change much." Their messaging is take little steps. Don't change much. You want to lose weight? You don't have to lose all of it right away. Don't change much, a little bit. You want to stop smoking? Start cutting down. So, you know, there is a lot to what you just said and an approach to our behavior. Well, I truly appreciate both of your expertise and time and willingness to engage. I can't thank you. Grace and I have never met. Joe, I had the pleasure of meeting in the past. And it's what makes this podcast so worthwhile, is to have people who are willing to help others through their time and generosity. So thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This completes another episode of the original Guide to Men's Health podcast. We wish to thank all guests who volunteered their time and knowledge. The information presented is the opinion of the speakers. The show's recordings are engineered and edited by Sean Fox. Episode titles and descriptions, as well as editing assistance, are provided by Dr. Kathleen O'Connor, PhD. Music for our show is San Juan Bells, written and performed by Dr. David Weidig. The podcast is sponsored and published by the Washington State Urology Society. The original Guide to Men's Health is an original publication of the Washington State Urology Society. Reproduction and use without the expressed or written consent of the Society is prohibited. For more information about men's health and previous episodes, as well as additional recommended resources, visit us online at theoriginalguidetomenshealth.com. This is Dr. Richard Pellman thanking you for listening and reminding you to take care of yourself.